danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 267 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From Melrose, Massachusetts, I'm Nate Mavis, and with me from Bend, Oregon, maybe, or maybe somebody else.
Portland, Oregon.
Oh, all right. Nice city. How do you like it?
I've been here before, but I like it. It's remarkable to me how Portlandy Portland is. Like, the kind of Portlandia stereotypes of Portland hold up pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah, and do you like that?
Mostly. It's like, it's hard for me not to feel kind of self-conscious about like being a stereotype or something like that, but a lot of hipstery things do actually appeal to me.
Yeah, it's interesting. I spent a little bit of time in the Somerville, Cambridge area last week, and like that is now even like probably much more than you would remember, is very hipstery and young professional, has a certain vibe, and it exceeds even my expectations of how much it will be. And you know, as much as some of that kind of suits me, I'm very happy to be out in the suburbs a little bit more. Yeah. I'm happy to have this vibe,
and I'm hoping that I'm going to get to see Carlos this evening. Apparently, he's also around the Portland area. It's hard to make firm plans with Carlos, but I told him that I was thinking of going to the Meadows Poker Room, which seems to be the largest of the Portland area poker rooms, so I think I may get company for that, whether or not we end up doing anything else.
Very good. Say hi to Carlos for me.
I will. And then tomorrow, I fly to Montreal, and we'll play WCoop.
Yeah, good luck.
Which I was actually kind of debating whether I was going to do that this year, play WCoop. But I have a friend in Montreal who I actually met through the podcast years ago, like the first time, or one of the first times I went to Montreal, like 2012, I guess at that time. That was before podcast, I guess, but he was a reader of the blog, and you know, I mentioned I was in Montreal, and he was like, hey, if you ever want to get a beer or something like that. And so you know, I did actually meet up with him, and he doesn't really play much poker these days anymore. It's not like we've become pretty good friends, and I see him whenever I go to Montreal. But it's funny because poker was like the reason that we met, but he's not really a poker, like, he was a pretty amateurish poker player. He doesn't really play much at all anymore, but we've kind of become friends anyway. And his roommate had just moved out, so he had like a, you know, spare room and an office and an extra monitor, like a pretty perfect online poker setup. So I was like, okay, I guess if I can go to Montreal, all I have to pay for is the flight, and then everything else is kind of taken care of. I guess I'll do that, because for some reason WCoop is only 2 weeks this year. They've made it smaller.
Well, maybe the tournaments will be bigger and possibly even better. That's
Well, and they also have they're doing kind of like the Scoop thing, so they have high, medium, and low buy-ins for all the events.
Oh wow. Okay.
So I'm not sure how that's changed. Like, I don't know if I didn't play Scoop this year, but as far as I know, Scoop still kind of proceeded as normal. So I don't know if they're trying to like merge those. I'm really not sure what the thing. Maybe they've written something about it, and I just don't know. But yeah, it's a little different than it's been past years.
Also, it's all blackjack. It's just a sort of the new stars.
It's not entirely wrong.
Very good. Well, good luck there. You know. Run well.
Because my own perambulations have been so unpredictable, I have not really lined up a guest for this week, but I don't think that bothers too many people other than me. I know a lot of folks are happy to hear Nate and me discuss strategy, and we've actually got a kind of interesting procedural question that I actually don't really know the answer to, and I'm hoping that Nate can explain this one. Of course, before we do that, we want to talk about our strategy sponsor, Tournament Poker Edge, which, you know, if you're looking to gear up for WCoop or learn from WCoop, you're going to find plenty of replays of my own and other people's play from various WCoop events. And even if you're not in a position to play WCoop, of course, there's still plenty that you can learn from it. And if you're strictly a live player, well, you'll find some hand history reviews from live tournaments as well. And I do think you can learn from the online stuff, even if you're playing live. So lots of great learning opportunities available to you for as little as $25 a month at tournamentpokeredge.com. We'll start with our procedural question. This one's coming from Matt. Matt says, "Hey, Nate and Andrew. Love the podcast and want to say thanks for the event with Just Hands last year. I had a great time and learned a lot. Never really got a chance to thank you guys for the excellent coaching and insight." So thank you, Matt, for coming. I think we enjoyed doing that event, but it's awesome to hear that you got a lot out of it. Matt continues, "One of my regular rooms recently changed a rule in a way that I pretty strongly dislike, and I thought it might make an interesting topic for the podcast. I love hearing Nate in particular talk about rules." So part of me is a little offended that he only wants to hear Nate talk about rules, but then it turns out I don't know the answer to this question. I'm a regular at Parks outside Philadelphia and recently noticed over the course of a couple sessions that more often than not, dealers were announcing the sizes of bets or raises or not announcing the sizes of bets or raises or even breaking down a stack of chips. After a while of feeling like I was constantly asking the dealers for the bet size, someone mentioned that management had recently changed the rule such that the dealers were no longer supposed to announce the bet size unless a player asked. This seemed odd to me, because I always want to know the exact size of a bet, and I feel like it's typically announced, at least in the New York games I'm more frequently playing. And it's annoying because I don't have the best eyesight. When I asked the dealers why the rule was changed, the only reason they gave was that's how they do it in Vegas, and that's the TDA rule. But that's just an appeal to authority, so I asked the shift manager. He explained that the reason they'd made the change is, one, some players had complained the announcement of bet sizes was altering the action, and two, this is how they do it in Vegas slash in the TDA rules. He said that dealers were actually supposed to be breaking down bets, but drew some fuzzy distinction for what would be broken down between when a player throws multiple chips out versus when a player slides out a stack of chips. He also said that I was the only person to complain and agreed with me that the new rule opens the door for some forms of angle shooting and slows the game down, but he didn't seem swayed. I wonder what you guys think. Is this really the standard or best rule? For my part, I don't think we should be worried that announcing bets, one of the few complete information parts of a game of imperfect information, would influence the action, unless the dealer is announcing it in such a way as to convey a reaction, but maybe there's some nuance I'm missing. Best, Matt.
All right. Anything you want to say before I start talking?
I mean, I guess at the risk of looking stupid, I'll say I'm someone on Matt's side that, I mean, I think it's a problem if a dealer is saying something like 200! But, you know, aside from that kind of thing, it seems to me, I see the potential for sort of angling or just kind of people, I guess you could say, like, just being able to eyeball a stack or knowing to ask or something like that is like a poker skill in and of itself, but it seems to me it's better when dealers announce bet sizes. So I'll put out there my potentially naive opinion.
I wouldn't say it's naive. I would say it's modern. And by modern, I mean like last 10 years. And it's not what I sort of constitutionally like, but that's just because my constitution was largely formed before 10 years ago, poker-wise. So the traditional rule, the traditional sort of Las Vegas slash cash game rule is you don't announce unless there's some special reason for it. Usually just the player asks. This has benefits and it has drawbacks, but that's the way it was. One thing that you might classify as either a benefit or a drawback is that it transfers money for the most part from worse players to better players. Every so often, like on Twitter or something, you'll see I remember one from the World Series a couple years ago where somebody moved all in. What was it?
I mean, I was once involved in probably one of the bigger controversies I've been involved in was a pot of lucky chances where I moved all in and my opponent called without asking for a count, and then, you know, the dealer didn't count it. And I mean, the dealer didn't have time. The guy called pretty quickly, but it turned out that it was a 1K chip that he didn't see. I mean, I think like that sort of sloppy mistake. I mean, in that case, he didn't even give the dealer a chance to count it, so we don't know whether he would have. But yeah. I mean, that sort of sloppy mistake is more likely to be made by a less experienced player.
Yeah, that's right. So here's, I think, what happened is, like, a rec player raised to say 10,000, and then some pro moved all in for 11,000, and the rec just, like, folded. Like, the dealer had started to break down the 11,000, like, very, very carefully, and, like, getting ready to announce how much it was, but at the World Series, you're not supposed to. And, like, the all-in player was like, has my opponent asked for a count? And the dealer stopped. Stopped doing that. Then the rec player eventually folded. Now, whether you think that's like a legitimate or illegitimate transfer of EV from the rec player to the pro, I don't know. I mean, that's whatever. You decide. But that's at least how it was originally. I also think there's a historical element here, like just a sort of causal path to trace here, is that 20 years ago almost all cash games in casinos were limit, and it would be a colossal annoyance if you announced every raise size and limit, because you already know what they are. So I think people just got used to raising, and that's that. As for the eyesight thing, that's too bad. I would imagine that this player, if he's a regular, his regular opponents and dealers may start doing him the courtesy of just assuming that he's asking and counting out the bets when he's in the pot. I also think he will improve at recognizing, like, the textures of like the visual textures of the different chips and you know the arithmetic that goes along with that. Every so often you run up. I talk to a colorblind player, and I once accidentally annoyingly raised this person from 20 to 80 when he had bet four red chips, and I raised him to 80 with three green chips and a red chip, forgetting that he was colorblind and in fact red green colorblind. But he was really sharp. He picked up on it right away. We were across the table too. I was impressed. I would say there's hope for you, Matt. Obviously, if you just kind of have crappy vision and it's not a colorblindness thing, that might be a little bit harder. But I think there will be accommodations for you. And also, I think in some card rooms and some jurisdictions, you may be entitled to ask for like different cards or some sort of ADA accommodations or something. That's a part of the game I don't know much about, but I've been surprised at least once before, although I can't remember exactly how. So maybe ask if like you're actually legitimately legally blind or partially so or something like that. As for what I think, yeah, the traditional rule is don't say it. More and more dealers do it. I think, you know, it's a pretty clear way in which online poker has gotten into the brick and mortar game. A lot of players got used to seeing the exact size of the bets and raises all the time. I think it's sort of interesting that Parx is moving back, especially now that it's regulars. Like, most of them probably never play online anymore. So probably at least one sort of counterfactual reason here is that they don't sort of have the relevant experience anymore or the relevant everyday experience these days that would cause them to, you know, expect all the bet sizes. But I find it helps me pay attention. I like the game without the announcements. I also like dealers. I don't abuse dealers, but another part of the sort of old school mentality is like dealers are meant to be seen and not heard. And like the more of, you know, it's, they've got a lot to do. I mean, this is like another reason for it. It's like dealers have a lot to do. They should be paying attention to a lot. They, you know, there are just a lot of parts of their job that sort of look silent. And in fact are silent, but that you don't notice, that, you know, it helps if they're paying attention to them. So counting out all the bets is something that, you know, takes time and attention away from the dealer, and I think it degrades dealer performance on some of these other things that really should be part of their job. So I'm also a bit of a traditionalist about, you know, what dealers ought to be doing.
I'm glad you added that last part, because I was going to ask you, is there an argument other than, it sort of just sounds to me like rank self-interest, the arguments before you got to the dealer distraction, when it's just kind of like, well, you know, if people misread a bet, then I could benefit from that. Like, that kind of strikes me as something that by itself doesn't seem like a very good reason to change a rule, or maybe even a bad reason to change a rule.
I mean, also it slows the game down, or it may slow the game down. I mean, under many normal conditions, it will slow the game down.
Yeah, that you know, strikes me as a more substantive argument, and the dealers have better things to do strikes me as a more substantive argument. But I mean, I have to believe some of the reason why people like that rule is they feel like it gives them an advantage in a way that I think they're not, you know, entitled to.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I also think, like, especially with the state of dealing these days, like,
yeah, I guess, like, getting the wrong count from the dealer is, like, that creates problems.
Yeah, and it's really hard. Like, there are just so many dealers out there who, like, will not who themselves have tells. And it's like when the tightest guy at the table raises, like, you know, there are just a lot of situations where I'm happy for the dealer to be keeping his or her mouth shut. And again, I love dealers. Dealers are great. It's just like this should not be a part of your job, I think. That said, you know, things change, times change. Online poker changed brick and mortar in a lot of ways, many of them for the better. And that's life. And, you know, I would say at this point, there's not really like a single true standard. I prefer the old way, and I think there's a reason that it persists in, I would say, not all of Vegas, but at least a lot of Vegas, and I think also at the World Series. And I like it that way. But I'm not offended by announcing bets the way I'm offended at a dealer rolling the deck.
Fair enough. Thanks, Nate, for enlightening me and Matt on that. And thank you, Matt, for writing. We have a strategy question now coming from Tony. And interestingly, Tony actually gave us, this is a hand he played against his brother, and he gave us a write-up from both players' perspectives. So I think we'll start it, and he doesn't specify which one he is. So we'll you know, just start looking at it from one player's perspective, and then, time permitting, we'll look at the other one as well. So Tony says, "This is a hand between my brother and me in our monthly home game that included a lot of psychology, and frankly, I think that led to a misplay by both players on the river. Between talking to my brother afterwards and just knowing him from playing with him frequently, I think I can fairly represent both of our mindsets in this hand. I'd love to get your input from both sides and any critique around who played this hand better and if either of us played this hand well. The game is a $51 no-limit hold'em game with unlimited live straddles, although few players actually straddle. Brother Y has $400 to start this hand, and Brother Z has about $500. Brother Y was down $200 or so, mostly losing to Brother Z, but has clawed back to $400 at the start of this hand, ticket to even for the night. So we'll start by looking from Brother Y's perspective. So this hand is nine-handed, and Y straddles under the gun to 350. The game has lots of action, and Y believes his post-flop play is better than most at the table, so is comfortable building action pots and trying to take advantage of others' mistakes. So I already want to pause here and talk about this decision. I think there are kind of like meta reasons why straddling can be, you know, good for the game or something like that, but if the implication here is that it's plus EV for Brother Y to put $3.50 into the pot blind from one of the worst positions at the table, it is not.
Yeah, no.
I think even button straddling, there's more of a case for button straddling potentially being plus EV, but straddling under the gun is never going to be plus EV. Or it's very difficult to construct game situations where straddling under the gun would be plus EV. Certainly, like, if the whole table agrees to do it, or if you kind of want to do it just to either make a particular player happy or give, you know, an appearance of action or spice up a game. I mean, there's lots of meta reasons why you might do it, but it's not going to be plus EV in that particular hand for you to voluntarily pay, you know, multiple big blinds blind.
Yeah, I would say I think I've pretty frequently in my career been one of the best players at the table, you know, especially in bigger pots. I can think of one game ever where in a vacuum my decision to straddle was probably plus EV. It's exactly what you would think. Like, I had, you know, the biggest stack by far, except, you know, maybe for the guy who was directly to my right and really bad and played particularly bad in big pots, etc. I'm not even sure it was right there, but yeah, I you know, it's, I would say maximum one ever.
Okay, so Brother Z is two to the left of Brother Y. Brother Y has straddled under the gun to 350. So Z is in middle position and raises to $12. Z is one of the tighter players at the table, and his raises are generally to be respected. A loose player on the button cold calls $12, and Brother Y, who the one who straddled, looks down to see pocket jacks. He says this deep, Y considers re-raising, but really doesn't want to face a 4-bet, and is pretty sure that if Z calls, the button will come along as well, and Y does not want to play jacks out of position against two players. So this is maybe the part of the hand that I actually want to take the most umbrage with. I think, for one thing, you're not that deep. And this is a comment, this came up on last week's strategy hand as well. I think people don't adjust when they think about how deep they are. They tend not to adjust for the fact that it was a straddled pot. So, in a $50 game, when you have a $400 stack, you're 400 big blinds deep. You're now effectively playing a 51 350 game. So you're a lot closer to 100 big blinds deep at this point, given that you've straddled. The preflop pot is much larger than it is typically in a $50 game, and as a result, there's more money to fight over preflop, and there's more reasons why people are going to be, like a raise to $12 in a $50 game is pretty different than a raise to $12 in a 350 game. So, and I think in particular, there's, because this issue of them being deep comes up later in the hand as well. And it seems like if you're going to have a sort of psychological block of just like not wanting to play a $400 pot, which seems like is kind of what's coming up here, or like being very risk averse when it comes to putting in $400, it's all the more reason not to be straddling in the first place. Like, you're sort of making the stakes very high, and then when the time comes around to actually play a large pot, you're like, oh, I don't want to play a large pot, I only have jacks. So I agree it could be a difficult decision if you get 4-bet. I actually think there's a pretty decent chance it would just be a fold if you get 4-bet. I think a lot of opponents don't 4-bet very often. And so there's a lot of value in re-raising with jacks in the situations where you get calls or folds. So even if getting 4-bet is not that appealing to you, or you think you're going to lose some value when you get 4-bet, I mean, I think it's the reason I say it's a relatively easy fold is I think a lot of people won't even 4-bet ace-king. Like, I think there's a fair chance Z is going to look at this the same way Y is and say, oh, I don't want to 4-bet ace-king, we're so deep, I better just call it. I don't want to play a big pot with ace-king. So, really what's going to happen, if you're going to get 4-bet very rarely, and you're basically only going to get 4-bet if your opponent has kings or aces, and it's going to be a pretty easy fold if you do happen to get 4-bet. But I think, when you get folds, that's a pretty good outcome. You get to win a pot right away rather than, because like Y says, he doesn't want to play out of position against two players, but that's exactly what's going to happen if he calls, right? Re-raising gives him a chance to potentially win immediately, or if he does get calls, he's getting calls from hands that are worse than jacks. So that's, and it's like kind of making it easier on yourself to play out of position. If you can re-raise to something like $60 here and you do get two calls, well, now your post-flop play is going to be pretty simple because you're going to be very shallow on the flop, and you can just kind of get all in when the flop is good for you and fold when it's not, and you don't really have to worry about having much of a positional disadvantage.
I like all that.
Sorry, did I say everything there was to say?
Yeah, no, it was a lot of it. I play with a lot of players who will 4-bet ace-king a lot here. I think if you're getting 4-bet every time by ace-king, I like the call a lot better. But if this is sort of as described, like a sort of home game type guy, and like even the raise size sort of suggests that, then I would 4-bet here. I would also say that like the fact that you have to fold is often a reason that you like getting 4-bet instead of not liking getting 4-bet. Like, obviously you can't hit a set anymore if your hand's in the muck, but generally it's most appropriate to say I don't want to get raised 4-bet whatever when you're actually gonna like lose money. Right. Like when that's just a way of restating some things that you said. So let's go to the flop.
Okay, there's now 37.50 in the pot after Y calls. Y is holding pocket jacks without the jack of spades, and the flop comes king 6-2 with two spades. So Y is out of position to two players. He has pocket jacks and no spade. King 6 deuce with two spades is the flop. Y checks. Z bets $30 into a pot of $37.50. The button folds, and Tony says, Y believes that Z is capable of continuation betting a wide range of flops, but is not the double or triple barreling type, so he calls to see what develops. And I will say, I mean, that's kind of a strong read to make on somebody, but then again, Y and Z are brothers, so it's not hard to believe that Y understands Z's game pretty well. And I do think that's a very, very useful to be able, a very useful thing to be able to think about going forwards. And so I like a lot that he has this plan of you know, already thinking ahead of not just what he's going to do if he faces barrels, but specifically how it's going to be exploited for him. So, you know, if he's right that Z plays in a very predictable kind of way and is only going to bet future streets when he has it and we'll check when he doesn't, then you know, that's really going to increase the expected value of a call here a lot. I mean, I think in a vacuum this would still probably be a call. Sort of, I mean, your hand is kind of underrepresented as a result of not re-raising pre-flop. That's a reasonably good flop for jacks. Like, I think call once and fold to more betting is a decent strategy with jacks anyway, but definitely given this opponent profile, it seems very clearly correct.
Well, okay. I'd say we have like a mild disagreement. I will say, if you really, really think that you won't get double or triple barrel like ever here, then you almost have to call. I will say that betting 30 into 3750 is a pretty big sign from a lot of players that they're in the value part of their range. And I was a little bit disappointed. Yeah. I was a little bit disappointed not to hear anything about the pot size. Again, they're brothers, so maybe like this is all baked in. I will also say, and this is not to say anything about our correspondent here, but a lot of players say things like this when what they mean is, I don't want to fold jacks, and I kind of feel like they're underrepresented.
Yeah.
And I am not going to fold. Like, if you really think this guy's a tight raiser, like, just go to Pro Poker Tools and see what your equity looks like. I know there's only one overcard. You might be surprised. Like, you're actually behind a lot. And especially if you think that the bet size skews strong, this is like a great spot to boost your win rate in low stakes live games, is by just like clicking fold when this stuff happens. That's not to say that like our correspondent has it wrong here, whether it's him or his brother that he's talking about. I'll just say that, like, if you find yourself thinking things like this a lot and acting like this in low stakes games, there's a pretty good chance you're just like punting a lot of calls away.
Yeah, those are very good points.
Yeah.
So Z does call, and we're heads up on the turn. There's now 9750 in the pot, and the turn is the jack of spades, making the
board. This is so funny, because like at pre-flop, like, I've been trying to figure out which brother is writing to us, and like it sort of feels like we've gotten more from Y psychologically, so like that kind of suggests it's Y. But at the same time, you know, like all this stuff about like, and you used to see this in forum posts a lot, it's like, Z, tight player, one must respect his raises, you know, this guy rock solid, extremely respectable gentleman, and now like that guy's probably gonna get bad beat also. So my money's starting to go on Z being our correspondent here. I don't know,
I had a very similar process reading through this. The turn is the jack of spades, making the board king, jack, six, deuce with three spades, and player Y holding pocket jacks. We don't yet know player Z's hand. Y starts to get excited, but opts to check given the flush draw hit with how deep the two players are. So as I said, again, we have this mention of the, you know, the two players being very deep. And at this point, we're looking at a stack to pot ratio of like 3.5. Right? There's about $350 in the effective stacks. There's $9,750 in the pot. So we're really not that deep. I don't think we're in a situation where you'd want to be folding jack. Like, I think essentially you can be getting all in with jacks here. Like, jack should be the best hand sometimes, including against hands that your opponent would be willing to get in with. And you're not drawing anywhere near dead, even if you are actually up against a flush. I mean, you wouldn't voluntarily want to put it in if you think your opponent's range will be only flushes. But I think it's sort of worst case scenario thinking to look at this turn card and say, oh, well, it's good, but it's not great. He might have spades. Yep. I better check and try to keep the pot small. Like, if he has, yep, if he has spades, he should be finding a way to get all the money in no matter what you do. So yep, I don't think you're gonna be able to control the pot against a flush.
Yeah. Also, what very, very, you know, especially if the original raiser is tight, what very, very important piece of information have we not been given?
I don't know.
is the king one of the spades?
Oh, yes. Very good point.
Especially given like the texture, since some of the even some pretty tight players will raise things like Jack 10, Queen Jack of Spades, but we know that the Jack is one of the spades. So like really like Ace King and maybe King Queen of Spades are like two, like really the two likeliest. It's really not easy for the other guy to have spades.
I'm embarrassed I didn't get that.
Yeah. Especially if like Jacks shouldn't be, three bet before the flop. Then you really, really, really need to care whether the king is a spade.
Why checks? And so I would say I think this is a pretty reasonable spot to consider a donk bet. Donk betting is kind of a separate, like that could be its own strategy discussion. But I think a lot of people just don't do it ever. Like they just always check to the person who was the aggressor on the previous street, which I think is actually a better strategy than like trying and getting it wrong in terms of like finding situations where donk betting would be correct. But I will say the times when it tends to be correct is when turn or river or even flop is one that kind of dramatically changes the nature of the board and maybe even shifts which player is likely to have the equity or the nuts advantage. And I think a spade is a pretty good example of this, where like there's a lot of blank turn cards or turn cards that are going to favor the player who is doing the betting, and you do want to be checking like the majority of turns. But I think the Jack of Spades is the kind of card where it really changes the dynamic. Like the addition of a spade is going to change the way the player who had been the aggressor in the previous street feels about a lot of hands in his range. And there's probably a lot that he's not going to bet when checked to, which is really not that great for you when you have jacks. I mean, on the one hand, you're going to be kind of happy to see a check because it makes it less likely that your opponent has a flush. But on the other hand, you're going to be unhappy to see a check because, A, the pot's not getting any larger, so your opponent's getting closer to showdown when he has a hand like top pair or an overpair. And, you know, there's a real risk that the river is going to be a fourth spade, which is also pretty bad for you. So I do see some reasons why the player Y might want to have a donk betting range in this spot. And I think pocket jacks would be a pretty reasonable hand to include in that range. And, you know, I would be planning on calling a shove, although I wouldn't be happy to face one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, Y does check, and Z also checks. Y now feels he's pretty safely ahead and plans to value bet a lot of rivers, hoping to possibly get paid off by ace-king, king-queen, ace-ace type hands, or just taking it down if Z has air, since he's not the river bluffing type and likely won't bet if checked to. Still 97.50 in the pot, the river is a 6, making the final board king-6-deuce-jack-6 with 3 spades on board. Y had been reading some poker books recently and is working on doing more river betting and not always, quote, just fearing the nuts, so he leads out for $66. And I will say, you know, that the what he said in the previous paragraph about, you know, Z's not the river bluffing type, so I'm going to do my own value betting on the river, I think that's very good. I think especially now with the board pairing, there's not a lot to be afraid of. I mean, it's like exactly pocket kings and pocket sixes is all that you're losing to. So, yeah, this is definitely not a situation where you should be fearing the nuts. I mean, I think the question here is, do you check raise the river or do you bet? And I think he's given some pretty compelling reasons for betting rather than trying to check raise.
Yep.
Z thinks for a few seconds and counts out a raise to 150. So Y bet 66 into 97.50 with Jack's full, and Z now has raised to 150. Y decides he's calling here at a minimum, but then realizes, given the fact that he's often the, quote, big brother bully, and could be seen as tilting given some earlier losses to Z, decides to go all in and hopes to get Z to spew. What are your thoughts here, calling versus shoving?
As described, I think I just like a call. You're losing to almost nothing, but is the player described going to raise this river with aces or ace king? Probably not. If he's bluffing, he's just going to fold. Even if he has aces or ace king, he could fold to a shove. So, you know, as described, I'm just calling.
I mean, I guess the real question is, how often do we think he has a flush, and do we think he's going to raise call it off with a flush on the river?
Yeah, I think he usually bets the turn with a flush. I'm mostly worried about King's full here. I mean, it's a little odd to check the turn with King's full, but I don't know. Yeah, he could also check the turn with a flush. I mean, he's probably paying it off if he has a flush. Is he really raising the river with a flush? Eesh. there's so few flushes, like ace queen, ace 10.
Yeah, I'm thinking like, again to what you said about the knowing whether or not the king is a spade. Like, it's starting to seem pretty relevant.
What can I say? Yeah, I don't know. I guess if he like exactly turned the nuts, I mean, I don't like the check, but I could see it. You know, especially if the king's not a spade, like betting a lot is something that you see with like a pair and a flush draw a lot. Okay. You know, I'm starting to like a shove a lot better. Ace queen of spades, ace ten of spades. I mean, if he has too many more of those aces of spades, you gotta three bet here before the flop. Like, if he can have like ace nine of spades, then you should not be just calling with jacks.
That's the thing. There's a lot of weird stuff that's happened like earlier down the game tree that makes this kind of an odd spot now.
Yeah.
Like the assumptions that would lead one to not three bet jacks pre-flop kind of change how we're going to play a lot of these other spots, but I think we should be three betting the jacks pre-flop, which then makes me want to do different things in some of these other spots like further down the game tree.
Yeah, I mean, it really, like, that's tough. I mean, I think if you've been playing, you know, what I actually think is that if you've been playing poker your whole life with this guy, you should know whether he has it. that's kind of what, like, I think if you're asking some schmuck in Melrose, Massachusetts, what to do against a shove here, then maybe, yeah, or against a raise. Very tough, very tough. A lot of people I'd just call against, but especially if somebody's just going to check back when they have the nuts. And this is like a tick you get sometimes, like even when you have a really good value hand that can leave a lot of other value hands in your opponent's ranges, like the nut flush, you see people check. So if that's the case, like if he's going to check behind with the nuts a lot, I mean, and by a lot I mean a lot of the time that he gets it, then I like a raise. But it's close. You tell me. You're the brother.
Let's flip it around and look at it from Brother Z's perspective now. So we still don't have the full results, but we're about to find out Brother Z's hand. So Brother Z is holding ace three of spades. It turns out he does in fact have the ace high flush on the river. Yeah. So from Brother Z's perspective, we're going to back to the preflop action now. Brother Y, who likes to give the illusion of action, straddles to 350. Z is in middle position and sees ace three of spades. Knowing that Y actually folds more than others who straddle, and given Z's tight image, he decides a raise to $12 could clear out the field. I'm not a huge fan of assuming that your image is changing preflop action all that much, but that said, I do think ace three is a pretty reasonable raising hand from early position, ace three suited specifically, and I think that having this read that the straddle might fold a little more than he should, like, I think it's sort of a close decision in a vacuum whether or not to open like a small suited ace in early position. In a looser game, I think it's not a great idea. But if you have reason to believe that the straddle is going to be on the tighter side, then I think there's some pretty good reasons why you might want to raise with this hand. Yep. Loose guy on the button calls, as does Y. A lot of Y's range here is middle pairs and suited connectors or Broadway-type cards. It's not total junk, but it can't be that good, as he definitely re-raised, especially against Z. There's 3750 in the pot. So this I really enjoy, because we've already seen each brother make a wrong assumption about the other one. So Y is like, oh, Z always has it. Can't three-bet him, and Z actually has ace-three. And now yeah. Z is saying, oh, you know, Y just called. He didn't re-raise me. He can't have, you know, a big pair, and he actually has jacks. I think goes to show the danger of putting too much stock in these reads. I think in terms of, like, how to use reads, it's good to have a sense of what would the vacuum play be without a read, and then you can have a sense of, like, how much are you deviating from the sort of default play. Because I think with the jacks, it's a pretty big deviation to not three bet, and clearly the read wasn't that strong to justify making a really big deviation. But when it comes to a decision like whether or not to raise ace three suited in early position, that's a decision that's kind of very close in a vacuum. And so a small thing like thinking that the straddle is going to fold a little bit more than he should, that could be enough to swing it towards a call. So I think it's good to have a sense of what are close decisions first, and then to use reads more to break close decisions than, like, I think a lot of people just like to jump straight to the read, and I think they sometimes kind of over-adjust when they don't actually have that strong of a read.
Yep, I like all that.
So we've got 37.50 in the pot, and the flop is King-6-deuce with two spades. Z is holding ace-three of spades, recall. Y checks, and Z decides to make a good-sized bet on a semi-bluff and bets $30, which I think is, again, kind of like fine in a vacuum, but I wonder how balanced this bet is. Like, I think that we might just only see this $30 bet from, you know, either from flush draws or from, like, flush draw and ace-king kind of hands, which is still not actually that balanced of a range. That's still actually a very strong range. I think there's a good chance that you would want to just choose a bet size that's more consistent with how you'd bet a variety of hands here, rather than just looking at your two cards and saying, like, this seems like a $30 hand.
Yep.
The button folds, and Y calls. So from Z's perspective, Y could have a king, or hopefully worse, spades, because he loves suited connectors. There's now 97.50 in the pot, and the turn is the jack of spades. Y checks, and Z opts to get tricky and checks back the nuts, knowing that Y likes to make plays on the river when Z shows weakness. Also, it appears that there are a few river cards to worry about. Z knows that the by-the-book play is the bet, but this feels like a good place to trap. What do you think, Nate? Is it a good place to trap?
Nah, trap with ace-king. Like, if he's going to make plays, like, you have a lot of combinations of hands that, like, you know, have other reasons not to want to bloat the pot. Like, all the reasons you gave are reasons that, like, checking behind with some other hands is better, and you have a lot better sort of natural reasons for wanting to check behind with other hands, and this hand loses too much when your opponent does have a king, and especially if you think that he's got, like, a king or a worse flush a lot of the time, then just go ahead and bet. Like, is he really going to fold a lot? Like, I don't know. Probably not. So I would check some hands, but I would bet this one. What do you think?
Yeah, I think a common misunderstanding is that, like, even in situations that seem good for trapping, the nuts is often not the best hand to trap with. Like, I think people tend to get this wrong, where they want to do something trappy when they have really strong hands. And in fact, as you indicated, Nate, it's often medium strength hands that are better as traps, because with a strong hand, there's a clear trade-off where if you choose to play it as a trap and check, like, there's also a lot of value in betting a strong hand. And so even if trapping is plus EV, like, of course it's plus EV, you have the nuts. The question is it the most plus EV thing that you could do? And because it's trading off with another plus EV thing, which is betting, it's a little bit less appealing. When you can get the same trapping value from a hand that doesn't benefit very much from betting, like if you have, I think you like ace-king with or without a spade. You know, ace-king is a hand that if you don't improve to a flush, you're probably not going to want to put three bets in with it anyway. Like, you're probably not going to want to bet turn shove river if you just have an unimproved ace king. So you're not giving up that much by not betting. You're only going to put one more bet in the pot with ace king anyway. So you can do it by checking the turn and value betting the river, or checking the turn and calling the river. You don't need to bet the turn if you're only going to put in one more bet anyway. When you have the nuts, obviously you'd like to put in a lot more money, and you're missing the chance to do that if you check the turn. Like, that's kind of the reason why the nuts tends not to be the greatest trapping hand.
Yep.
And as you pointed out, there's very clear value targets. So, like, and in fact, I think those hands are probably more likely to be in Y's range than something that would bluff. Like, it's not even clear to me what is the hand that Y would call the flop with and then try to get tricky and bluff the river.
Like, yeah, that's a super important thing, especially with the, like, large in absolute dollars pre-flop raise size. Like, the flop came king 6-2. Yeah, and the flop bet size. Like, what does he have? Like, is he really, like, making a bad peel with pocket sevens?
I don't know. Or, like, that's 7-6 of diamonds. I mean, I can kind of imagine a few, you know, hands that might do that, but I think it's, like, just combinatorically, I think it's more likely that he has a king or a flush than it is that he has a bluff. So I think the building your strategy around getting value from his bluffs is not the way to go.
Yeah, and, like, also even those hands, which we are kind of groaning as we're imagining, like, those hands are pairs that beat ace-queen offsuit on the river, right? So, like, he might not even bluff with them.
The river is a six. Still 97.50 in the pot. Z is holding ace three of spades, and the final board is king six deuce jack six with three spades. So Z has a flush, but a full house is possible. And as we know, Y actually has a full house. Z feels 99% sure that Y doesn't have kings, as he would have re-raised pre-flop. That leaves only jacks, sixes, or twos, as Y is not the type to play rags like jack six, king six, or six deuce. That isn't a lot of hands, plus Y could have a lot of worse flushes. Given the little brother has been giving the big brother the business, he's likely itching to call, perhaps even with a hand as weak as king queen. Considering that, Z raises to $150. What do you think? Facing the bet, you were kind of, like, when we looked at this from Y's perspective, you were kind of questioning whether or not Z would raise with a flush. What do you think about his reasoning for it?
I mean, I think flushes are really good. I think the reasoning is a little bit weak in the sense that, like, preflop, you know, we heard that the big blind likes suited connectors, but we didn't hear anything about semi-connectors. Like, actually, there's a king and there's also a jack, and we still don't friggin' know whether the king is the king of spades. And, like actually count the flushes. There actually aren't that many, especially if the king is one of the spades. Like, you know, there's, and especially if the big blind won't call with hands like queen eight, actually count them up. Not that many. That said, you know, they're brothers. They like to battle. You have the nut flush. There are some flushes out there. He's not going to fold a flush, probably. Like, yeah, sure, raise. That's fine, I think.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. And I like that, because, like, a lot of people tend to do only half the work here, where, you know, he starts by saying, well, it's kind of unlikely that I'm behind. There's only a few combinations I could be losing to. Well, that by itself doesn't tell us that we should raise. We also have to think about what are the hands that are actually going to call a raise that we're going to be ahead of. But once he starts mentioning, well, he could have king queen, he didn't mention king jack, but that seems like a pretty good possibility for player Y, the player who called from the straddle as well. Once we start counting the number of these top pair combinations, if you think that you're going to get called by those, then those outnumber the number of boats that you're going to run into, and that's the reason to raise. It's not as simple as just saying, well, I'm probably good, therefore I raise. You have to expect to still be good if the raise is called. That's why it's so important to continue to consider the possibility of, you know, getting called by a king.
Mm-hmm.
Then Y goes into the tank for about 20 seconds and announces all in. Z snap calls because he doesn't want to outthink himself and is highly confident he's ahead. So on the one hand, if you're highly confident you're ahead, of course you should call. But I think the problem here is Z hasn't updated his feel about his hand based on the fact that he just got 3-bet all in on the river. So I think he just sort of started when he was facing the river bet and said, well, I probably have the best hand, therefore I raise. And then, like, so I kind of wonder, like, what hand would you raise here and then fold to a shove? Sounds like probably no hand. So if you just make the decision that you were good based on the information that you had at the time that you raised, well, now you have new information, which is that your opponent wants to 3-bet you all in. And at this point, it's pretty hard for me to see what he could expect to be winning with ace-three of spades. So I think he would just have to assume that the opponent is, like, either bluffing too much in this situation or overvaluing hands in this situation, like that he's somehow jamming all in with just trips or with a lower flush or something, and that strikes me as a lot, given that we know from Y's perspective, Y was kind of questioning whether he could even jam jacks full for value. I would like to see some discussion of what Z thinks he's going to beat when he calls here.
Yep.
And of course, it turns out Z is kicking himself when he ends up losing to a full house. So Tony concludes, love the podcast, guys. It's on my must-listen list every week. And yes, I've already given you a 5-star rating on iTunes, which, thank you very much. Feel free to follow suit, everyone else. I know it must be a lot of work to consistently put out this high level of content, so thank you for that. And count me in the camp of people who mostly love the 30-minute analysis for one hand. It's definitely helped me to think better about poker. So thank you, Tony. We've managed to squeeze 30 minutes out of this hand. I don't know that I want to comment on which brother played it better. I don't even know that that's really a meaningful question to ask, but I think we've found opportunities where each brother could have improved his decision-making, and hopefully that's good enough.
I agree. Thank you, Tony. Thank you, Andrew. And thank you to everybody out there listening. Have a great week.
Take care.
or the devotion of a Carmelite, or the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.